When you wake up in the morning, are you raring to go? Or do you think to yourself, what could possibly be the point? Doing what works will help you see it isn't too late to go after your dreams. We talk with experts about everything from getting in shape to finding work you love. We're your guide to a better life. Now, here's your host for Doing What Works, Maureen Anderson.
If you have a sneaking suspicion that you could be more successful than you already are, do I have a treat for you today on Doing What Works. Dr. Marshall Goldsmith is joining us. Harvard Business Review calls Marshall the world's number one leadership thinker. CEO Global of Canada calls him the world's number one leadership speaker, and Fast Company has called Marshall America's preeminent executive coach. He's the author or editor of 35 books, and his latest just hit the New York Times number one spot for best-selling business books. It's Triggers, Creating Behavior Change That Lasts, Becoming the Person You Want to Be. It's an honor to have you back, Marshall.
Oh, it's great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
I was talking with Daryl Anderson, my husband and producer, who will be joining us on the show as always, about how you are such a fountain of wisdom, Marshall, that I don't know how to keep the interview from becoming kind of an information dump. It almost feels like I would turn on a faucet and out would pour the inspiration.
Well, thank you very much.
So I guess in hopes of asking you a question you're not always asked, at least not right off the top, how do you raise kids who don't need to hit bottom before they change?
Well, you know, I'm not the world's authority on raising kids, but I would say the important thing is give the kids a sense of what is happiness and meaning for them. So, you know, and realize that in life, happiness and meaning is not going to come from the outside anyway. It's going to come from the inside. And what is happiness and meaning for you? And to the degree they can try to achieve that, they're probably going to have a good life.
That's an interesting perspective, especially in the age of get into the best or the most elite college to try to get the highest paying job right out of college and so on. It just seems like there's such a sense of pressure put on kids at an earlier and earlier age for those external gold stars.
Well, there is, and you know, that's not for no reason. It's global competition is very, very tough. My daughter, I'm very proud of her. She got a PhD from Yale University, and there were 22 students in her class. She was the only one born in the United States. And they were not really there to get drunk and go to parties. They're pretty serious kids. So it's tough out there, and I think part of, you know, becoming who you want to be is having a dream and going for it. The other part is realizing you have to pay a price for it. And in the new world, the price is probably going to be bigger than it used to be. In America, it used to be pretty easy to hit the middle class. Today, it's much, much more difficult. And I don't want to get into politics about what should or shouldn't be. I think we have to deal with what is.
And to raise a child who is dealing with what is, if you could have parents do one thing differently starting after this program, what would it be?
What would be is get them to focus their time on stuff that matters. The average kid, I wrote an article 20 years ago. Unfortunately, I was correct. I said within 20 years, media addiction will far surpass drug addiction and alcohol addiction combined as a social problem in the United States. We're there. The average kid that's flunking out of school spends 55 hours a week on non-academic media. 55 hours a week. That's more than a full-time job on non-academic media. That's an addiction. I teach at Dartmouth. A nice young man drives me back and forth. He's probably 32 years old. He's probably as smart as me. Flunked out of college, spent 25,000 hours of his life playing the video game World of Warcraft. Well, a couple of things I'd say to young people. One is, live your own life. People spend so much time in vicarious living. You know, my neighbor in New York was Lindsay Lohan. How many millions of hours were spent people reading about Lindsay Lohan and Lindsay got drunk and she had a car wreck? Don't live vicariously. Live your own life. And to the degree you can get young people to focus on, what do I want to become? Who do I want to be? How can I live my own life not get lost in the lives of movie stars, athletes, gossip, other people's lives. And it's not just a theory. My daughter and I have done a lot of research on this. You're much more likely to be satisfied with your life if you live your own life and not someone else's.
Yes, and I agree with people who have said our phones are making us crazy.
I agree. Yeah, it's very easy to get trapped into this sort of media addiction where we just are constantly barraged by triggers from the environment to take us away from where we want to go. A classic case of, and we all have something called the monkey mind. Our monkey mind is like a monkey swinging through the jungle from vine to vine. The internet, it's amphetamines for the monkey mind. So what happens, have you ever had this happen? You go online, you're going to look up something that's going to take maybe 5 minutes. 3 hours later, you're still online, and you have no idea why you started in the first place. I think you have had this happen.
Dilbert creator Scott Adams says he has to chant. He has to, like, pick a task and then just keep chanting that phrase over and over to guard against that monkey brain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because if we don't, it's so tempting. Those triggers from the internet will just drive us to someplace, which probably has absolutely nothing to do with why we got there in the first place.
And yet it's a wonderful tool.
It's a wonderful tool. It's like anything that's good. Things are addictive, not because they make you feel bad. Things are addictive because they make you feel good. Question is, how do you use it?
Yeah. I want to touch on some other things in this hour. And one of the most interesting things I found about your book, Marshall, was your path to hairline acceptance. Can you tell us about that?
I was 25 years old or so, getting my PhD at UCLA, and I used to do this ridiculous hair comb over. I'm sure you've seen people do this. I hope I don't offend anyone. But, you know, they comb their hair from one side to the other with 4 or 5 strands trying to cover up their baldness. So I fall asleep at the barber, and he cuts my hair off equally at both sides. So I try to comb it over, but it only goes halfway. Makes me look like a complete idiot. So I look in the mirror, and I said, "You're bald. Take peace." As ridiculous as that sounds,
it freed up so much time and energy.
It did. Just making peace with the fact you're bald, it's okay.
For those of us who aren't bald or going bald, what's the lesson?
Well, you know, it's not just I'm bald, it's okay. I'm X number of years old, it's okay. Or I live in this home, it's okay. And the lesson is making peace with what is in life. You know, change what we can change and make peace with what you can't change.
It's sometimes difficult to know. And with someone who counsels as many executives as you do, I would like to hear some of your favorite excuses for not changing.
Well, we have many, many wonderful excuses. I'm probably the only teacher you've ever talked to who's collected feedback from tens of thousands of people who have been to my classes. And I measure, do they do what I teach and do they get better? And my biggest client years ago was Johnson & Johnson. And I got to talk to the top 2,000 people, all the way from Ralph Larson, who was the CEO, down to number 2,000. And they all said, 98% said, I'm going to do what Marshall taught me. A year later, 70% did something, 30% did nothing. So I got to interview the people who did nothing and said, why'd you do nothing? The number one excuse sounded like this. I'm incredibly busy right now, given pressures of work and home and new technology that follows me everywhere. I feel about as busy as I ever have. Sometimes I feel overcommitted. Every now and again, my life feels a little out of control. But you know, I'm working on some very unique and special projects right now. I think the worst of this is going to be over in 3 or 4 months. And after that, I'm going to take 2 or 3 weeks and get organized, spend some time with the family, and begin my new healthy life program. And after that, everything will be different. And it will not be crazy anymore. Have you ever had a dream that sounds like that dream?
Well, I used to, but you know what I realized is how often you flit around in my brain, Marshall. I had kind of forgotten that it was you I got it from.
Right.
But only this past week, I found myself starting to say that. Well, we're getting ready for this and things are... And I'm like, no, that's Marshall's deal about it's never going to be less crazy. Figure it out now. And well, I got back to work.
And the other thing is, when we make plans for life, we assume the planner is the same as the doer. Well, the planner is not hungry and staring at chocolate cake. The doer is hungry and staring at the chocolate cake. We believe if I understand, I will do. There's a huge gap between I understand and I do. And one of the others I talk about, a bunch of them, one of the others I talk about is We believe we can rely on willpower and we're above the need for help, structure, and direction. Wrong.
It's what Seinfeld calls night guy versus morning guy.
Yeah.
Night guy wants to stay out late and doesn't care what happens. That's morning guy's problem.
That's right. That's right.
So your book is written, I assume, to help people put structures in place to save them from themselves. Is that a good way to put it?
Very good way to put it. And because as we journey through life, we know who we want to become. We don't become that person. We are constantly bombarded by triggers that take us off track. And if we don't have some structure, some sense of help, some sense of direction, it is very difficult to stay on track. Very, very difficult to stay on track. And I talk about in the book ways to do that.
My favorite of all of those, and maybe it's because I'm hitting a certain age where my body keeps changing the rules for this happening, but sleep. You wax endlessly on the importance of getting a good night's sleep. It's the key to everything.
Well, you know, it's very interesting how few of us get a good night's sleep. So what happens is, and most of it is, we just get lost. Again, you're at night, and I'll just watch this TV show or check something on the internet, and then we don't get enough sleep. I use a case study in my classes. I'm traveling constantly. I have over 12 million frequent flyer miles now. If I'm not careful, I check into the hotel, click, there's a made-for-TV movie on, an idiotic made-for-TV movie about some mother killing her cheerleader daughter's friend in Texas. And 2 hours later, I've watched this ridiculous movie. I look at myself, I don't get enough sleep, and I say to myself, what an idiot. I gave this example in my class at Dartmouth. A young guy in the back raised his hand. He said, I watched that movie twice. Why did you watch it twice? He said, I don't know. It was so stupid the first time, and then I watched it again. You know,
got to interrupt, Marshall. I'm sorry, but there's lots more of Marshall's advice next on Doing What Works. Back with Doing What Works. I hope you agree we are making it worth your time to tune in today. My guest is Dr. Marshall Goldsmith, who's been recognized for the past 4 years as one of the top 10 business thinkers in the world and the top-rated executive coach at the Thinkers 50 ceremony in London. His new book just hit number one for business books on the New York Times prestigious list. And that book is Triggers, Creating Behavior Change That Lasts, Becoming the Person You Want to Be. Marshall, I had heard the story about David Letterman keeping his room frosty where he records his show or used to record his show.
Right.
And I found it interesting in your book that you alluded to that, because I think one of the most important keys to doing what works is noticing what works. And you had a personal experience with temperature in a room.
Yeah, I was teaching a class for McKinsey, a big consulting firm. You know, I taught like 20 classes there. They'd all gone very well. The people are very bright. They always enjoyed it. But this class, everything seems to be very slow, and people seem to be checked out, and I seem to be kind of sluggish. And I'm doing all this deep psychological analysis of what's wrong with me, what's wrong with them. You know, and then I just realized I was sweating, and the room was too hot. And then I just got the temperature turned down, and all of a sudden everything was fine. Everybody was lively. All my deep psychological analysis was the room's too hot. And since then, I found the number one cause of problems in training and development programs is the room's too hot.
And isn't that interesting about life? The solution doesn't have to be complicated. I think of sleep, and I sleep way better when the room's cold.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and also just the solution doesn't have to be complicated. Back to that sleep thing, though, it requires discipline. We don't think about sleep. Anything requires discipline. Happiness requires discipline. Sleep requires discipline. If we don't have any discipline, we just tend to, you know, we tend to bump along in life and just sort of go where the world treats us. You know, a good way to look at this is like if you look at a continuum. On one hand, I control the world, and on the other hand, the world controls me. And in my book, Triggers, my assumption is they're both true. we do create our world, and at the same time, our world creates us, and we just need to be aware of this interplay.
I think grown-ups need bedtime.
Yep, they do. They do, often more than children.
And the first way that works is if you cut off the screens about an hour beforehand. That's my experience.
Definitely. I totally agree with you. And also, if you measure it every day. See, if you measure it every day, you're much more likely to do it.
I agree, and it explains the popularity of those little Fitbit wristbands. Do you wear one?
Oh, I do, and it measures how many minutes, for example, how many steps you take.
Yep.
Yeah.
And do you get kind of competitive with it?
Well, it's good, though. It keeps me, it helps me stay in shape.
All right, let's talk about what happened when you were being interviewed by Lester Holt. I love this story, too.
Well, you know, what happened is, you know, we were supposed to cover a bunch of stuff, and, you know, the time goes so fast, because you only have a few minutes. And then, you know, then I had this instinct to say, well, I'm not done yet on national TV. That's impressive. Excuse me, Lester.
Yeah.
I'm not done yet. Fortunately, I didn't. You know, I was prepared and thoughtful enough. I didn't say it, but I was tempted to sit there and say, I'm not done yet. You know, that would have been such an idiot.
Do they prep you? Do they warn you how fast it's going to go?
They do, but it doesn't matter.
It doesn't sink in, probably.
It still
yeah.
seems to go way faster than you can imagine.
I think there would be a lot of maturity involved in, though, having that discussion with yourself as it's happening.
Well, again, the idea is, you know, just the discipline of being conscious of where you are and what's going on prevents you from blurting out the first thing that comes to our mind. As we journey through life, the typical reaction is there is a trigger. The trigger produces an impulse, and the impulse leads to behavior. What I talk about in the book is if we can change the cycle a little so there is a trigger, it still will produce an impulse, but we have an awareness of what's going on around us. Then we realize we have a choice. Then we exhibit the behavior. And if you can just get to that level of awareness and choice, most of the time, when I say most, I think 80, 90% of the time, we'll probably come up with a good solution.
That might be a good thing to pick up on after the break, because the key, I think, is seizing a couple of seconds even to not react. There's no law that says you have to react within a half a second of being triggered. And I can't wait to hear what Marshall says about that. Also, I think you'll enjoy the story of how he decided to become the person he was meant to be. All of that is ahead on Doing What Works.
Doing What Works airs on great radio stations across the country, like KEUN-AM in Eunice, Louisiana.
You are listening to Doing What Works, and we are, I hope, helping you do more of what works in your own life. We have such an expert with us. Dr. Marshall Goldsmith joins us to share wisdom from his latest book, another New York Times bestseller, Triggers, Creating Behavior Change That Lasts, Becoming the Person You Want to Be. Marshall's written two other New York Times bestsellers, Mojo and What Got You Here Won't Get You There, which was also a Wall Street Journal number one business book. Marshall is the winner of the Harold Longman Award for Business Book of the Year and one of the Nielsen BookScan top 10 best-selling management book authors. Marshall, you were talking about triggers and how there's the trigger and then what?
Well, typically it's trigger, impulse, behavior. And the idea is if you can go trigger, impulse, then awareness. Awareness of, wait a minute, there is a trigger, I have this impulse. Become aware of that, then realize I have a choice. I have a choice before I behave. I'll give you two examples, negative and positive. The negative is, you know, you're driving the car. The person next to you in the front seat says, look out, there's a red light up ahead. If we're not careful, what do we say? What do you mean there's a red light? Do you think I could see and how to drive this car? And just shut up and let me drive. You start screaming at the person in the front seat, who, by the way, is just trying to save our lives. I gave this example at Dartmouth, and the guy said to me, he said, I have an embarrassing story. He said, He said, 2 weeks ago, I ran through a red light. And he said his wife was always correcting his driving. So he looks at his wife and says, never correct my driving again. I want to drive. I'm sick of you correcting my driving. He said, I'm embarrassed to say, 2 weeks ago, I ran through a red light, plowed right into two cars. He said, thank God no one was hurt. He looks at his wife and goes, why didn't you say anything?
Because well, I'd rather die than keep being with you.
Exactly. Well, well, that's the negative case study. Now, the positive case study I mentioned in my book is, and I got an email, this wonderful email. This young man sends me an email. He said, I want to send you an email today and say thank you. He said, I was having a terrible day, and my wife called up, and she was under a lot of pressure, and I was under a lot of pressure, and she started talking about what a hard day she was having. And my instinct was to prove that, you know, my problems were far more important than hers, and her problems pale in significance to my own, and that, you know, I'm busy. But he said, for some reason, I remembered your talk about don't always try to win and be right, and I stopped, and I breathed, and I just listened, and I said, I love you. Thank you for all the sacrifices you made for our family. Then he said, I went home. I spent $25. I bought her some flowers. I gave her the flowers, and I said, I love you. He said, that was the best $25 I've ever spent. Thank you very much. Well, you know, if you just had that discipline to stop and breathe and think, there is a trigger. I have an impulse. But rather than just act, think, become aware. This is my wife. This is not the enemy.
Yeah.
This is my wife. I have a choice. I mean, I can act like an ass or not. I don't have to act like an ass. And then do what, then behave. If we just have the discipline to do that, life gets a whole lot better.
Suddenly I realize that Daryl has you to thank for something good that's been going on in our marriage, Marshall, in the last 3 years. Would you like to hear what it is?
I'd like to hear it, too.
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, honey, how I have been, when I offer you feedback, you know, like maybe a suggestion for how things might go, instead of dwelling on the mess that was made, I'm like, you know, for the future, you know, if you ever want to, and I realized last night, Marshall, researching the show, I got it from you.
Good.
Yeah. It's like, it doesn't matter what happened in the past. None of us appreciate a photographic memory our spouses have of all our sins.
Right.
But if there's a point to it, like if you do this next time, it'll go so much better. I'll be in such a better mood, and that will only double back on you.
Right. That's good.
So the other thing I realize as you're talking, Marshall, is something that I used to think of as a flaw, which is not being that quick on my feet in every situation, is really a blessing, because it sometimes takes me hours to realize that someone has been rude. And I think if I was the person who realized it immediately, it would be harder to resist the temptation to let them know that I noticed them being rude, versus this way, you know, we're already somewhere else before.
Exactly.
It. So.
Well, and typically when someone is rude, then we feel we have to be rude back.
Yeah.
So then it becomes a contest.
It does. Isn't that sad?
It is. It's a contest. Who's the biggest jerk? And why get into a contest?
So we were at this big gathering a few weeks ago, and one of the guys that Daryl knew, oh, decades ago and not very well even then, started making these really racist remarks, you know, and it's mixed company. And it's one of those situations where it's so over the top. You feel like by staying in the situation, you are condoning it somehow.
Right.
What would you do in that situation?
Leave.
You would?
Yeah, just...
Walk away.
Walk away.
Okay. Here's what I did, because it wasn't an easy situation to walk away from. It was a small enough gathering that it'd be very obvious, and, you know, everybody else was like, really good friends and so forth. So what I did was the following. I waited to make sure I heard him right. And I asked him to repeat himself. I said, what did you just say? And he repeated it. Unfortunately, I thought maybe he would wise up and shut up. And so from then on, I didn't laugh. You know, that was my big act of rebellion. I'm hoping that was an okay second best choice, but
yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the things I talk about in the book is a chapter called AWOT, Am I Willing at This Time to Make the Effort Required to Make a Positive Difference on this topic?
Mm-hmm.
And my book is not prescriptive. I don't tell you who you want to be. The goal is to help you become the person you want to be. Well, Peter Drucker taught me a good point. Our mission in life is to make a positive difference, not to prove how smart we are. So you have to ask yourself, am I going to make a positive difference? If you are, go for it. And if you're not, why are you dealing with it? Well, am I willing to make the investment required to make a positive difference on this topic? Oh, most of our lives are wasted on things where we're not going to make a difference anyway. The weather, traffic, Lindsay Lohan, athletics, we're not going to change any of that stuff. Yet we waste hours and hours of our lives carping about things we're going to do absolutely nothing about anyway. Put your energy on something you can do something about, not something you cannot do something about.
Marshall Goldsmith, my guest on the show today. When we come back, I'll deliver on that promise to let him tell you what changed his life. That's ahead on Doing What Works.
The following is sponsored by the Knock 'em Dead Career Management Books.
Next is an old friend and a regular guest on Doing What Works, Martin Yate, New York Times best-selling author of the Knock 'em Dead Career Books. Martin drops by now and then to share advice on challenging job search and career problems. So, Martin, at a job interview, when a hiring manager asks that terrible question, what's your greatest weakness? What do you say?
We all share weaknesses. Even you and I have weaknesses, surprising as it may sound. And there's one weakness everyone on the planet shares, everyone in the professional world, and that's managing to stay current with the technology that's affecting your job and your profession. So in this instance, you start by talking about how the business is changing, the tools are changing, especially the evolving tools for productivity, and how keeping up with them takes a lot of time. And then you talk about how you are doing it. Right now, I'm reading about. I've just attended a weekend workshop. I'm in my fifth month of doing, and then you talk about a certification or a course you're doing that's relative to the job. It's a great answer. Or you can talk about how productivity has speeded up and how the importance for having powerful multitasking skills are much more important to success. Did you know that multitasking was one of the most frequently used requirements on all job postings?
I'm not surprised. Employers are always looking to get the most bang for their buck. I imagine this and many other tough questions are covered in your book, The Knock 'em Dead Job Interview.
In the Knock 'em Dead books, we have certain building blocks on which our philosophy of job search and career management is built. And one of these building blocks is a concept of learned behaviors, or what we call transferable skills and professional values, and there are 12 of them. And one of them is multitasking. And I explain how multitasking works. And it's not being pulled from one task to another. It's about staying on track and keeping your priorities right and using your time effectively. And if you read about it and you learn about the PDR cycle, that's the plan, do, review cycle, you can use this in your answer to an interviewer. And they'll be wildly impressed about what you're doing to turn a weakness into a strength, because no one has enough time to do things. You admit this, you are honest about it, and you finish the answer by showing what you've done and how you're improving.
For a special offer on Martin Yate's books and other job search services, visit martinyate.com and get 20% off anything in the Knock 'em Dead store. Enter the promotional code WHATWORKS. Again, that's martinyate.com. Learn to control your destiny.
You are listening to Doing What Works, and my criteria for guest selection are people who walk their talks. I can't think of a better example of that than Dr. Marshall Goldsmith. And Marshall, this is the point in the show where I want you to tell us who Paul Hersey is and how he changed you.
Well, you know, I was a young PhD student and professor, and he was kind enough. He was a top expert in our field and probably the highest paid consultant in organizational behavior in the world at the time. And he let me follow him around to kind of learn to do what he did and teach classes, and I practiced a little bit as a professor. Then one day he got double booked, and he said, can you do what I do? I said, I don't know. He said, I need help. Can you do this? I said, I don't know. He said, I'll pay you $1,000 for a day. That was 38 years ago. I was making $15,000 a year. You know what I said? Sign me up, coach. Well, I did this program, and I was very successful, and then I started doing very well. Then he gave me some great coaching advice, which I really didn't listen to for a long time. He called me in, and he said, you know, Marshall, your problem is you're too successful. You're making too much money. You're running around selling days. And if you're not careful, you're never going to make the investment required to be the person that you could be. That was such good advice. And, you know, I didn't listen to it for a long time. If I had to live my life over again, I wouldn't change a whole lot. That is one thing I would change. I would have listened to that advice at a much younger age. Because when we're successful, we get trapped into this, you know, just repeating what we're doing over and over again. When we get positive recognition, we're successful. Sometimes at the expense of doing stuff that in the short term doesn't pay off, but in the long term is going to make a huge difference in our lives.
What did you start doing differently then? When you did, well, first of all, before you answer that, why did you take his advice at some point then? What changed?
Well, I met Francis Hesselbein and Peter Drucker. I got on the board of the Drucker Foundation. We started writing, editing books and articles. And the first book we did was called The Leader of the Future, which was a hugely successful book. And then I started realizing I need to write, I need to think, I need to reflect. I need to come up with my own creative ideas, not just sing someone else's song. And that's kind of what I've been doing, is singing someone else's song. So I really started working on that myself. And, you know, I've used that now in my life a lot, so I keep trying to grow and write and do new and different things, as opposed to just be repetitive. I had a very interesting case study recently. I was in New York. My second home is in New York City. And I went to Madison Square Garden. I was watching Billy Joel. Excellent show. Sold out Madison Square Garden. But he apologized 3 times for not writing anything new in the past 25 years. I mean, nobody in the audience cared. But he apologized 3 times. I listened to him and I thought, you know, I don't want that to be me.
Huh.
I don't want to be singing the same song over and over again and apologizing because I didn't do anything new, no matter how successful I am.
You know, we saw Billy Joel at Madison Square Garden on a sold-out evening, and I had a different reaction to Billy. He's older.
Yeah.
When I would go to his concerts when I was in college, I would be so fired up watching him climb on top of speakers and using a microphone as a baton. I'd leave and think, I am going to do something really special with my life. And Billy's older now, and he doesn't have as much energy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong about that. It doesn't mean he's a bad person. But you know what I realized, Marshall? As I'm getting older, I do have more energy because I'm taking really good care of myself. And I thought, I have a lot less money than Billy Joel, but I feel more successful than him in some ways. Isn't that awful to admit, or is it?
I don't think it's awful at all.
It depends on what you consider success. What is your metric, right?
And again, here's what's important. As we journey through life, what matters? Happiness and meaning.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to make me happy and what's meaningful for me? And nobody can define that for him but him. Nobody can define that for you but you. And nobody can define that for me but me. And that doesn't mean anyone is right or wrong. Maybe in Billy Joel's mind, it's okay to sing the same song over and over again for 25 years. Maybe in somebody else's mind, it isn't. But the key is what's important for you. How do you define happiness and meaning? I've done 4 programs at my home with old guys and women who are, you know, like the 60s, getting ready to retire. And I talk, what matters in life, right? And I tell them, playing crappy golf with old men at the country club while eating chicken salad sandwiches every day and discussing gallbladder surgery may not be quite as dynamic as you might think.
And, oh my gosh, so many people are like gunning for that time. I just don't get it. One other thing about Billy Joel, though, he wouldn't apologize for it if it didn't bug him a little, would he?
That's what I'm thinking. That's
yeah.
What I was thinking, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, because nobody cared in the audience.
That's just it. That's just yeah. It. It kind of makes me ache for him. Well, as we go to commercial break, I want to share a story that I probably shared on the show before, but it's been a few years, and this is my best example of why I do the program. I learn so much from my guests. Marshall Goldsmith is one of those. And Katie and Daryl and I found ourselves at lunch with Marshall one day when he was speaking at a seminar we were attending. And Marshall asked me a question about guilt. And I said, I am 100% motivated by guilt. I was just surprised by the question, blurted out the truth, as you tend to do when you're surprised. He said, is that the example you want to give Katie? I burst into tears. Marshall helped me in about 3 minutes realize that Katie is going to learn the most, not from what I say, but how I treat myself. She is going to learn to treat herself the way I treat myself. And from that moment on, I mean, she was little. I think she was six. I started treating myself better. She has watched me do that. And now as a 20-year-old at NYU, you won't believe how many times she tells me that she's learning how to live from watching me. And I learned so much about that from Marshall. So there you go. I blew my own horn a little bit, Daryl, like you're always asking me to do. And that'll be it for that. More with Marshall in just a moment on Doing What Works. Thanks for listening to Doing What Works. I am trying to help you be more of the person you want to be by talking with someone who has helped me be more of the person I want to be. His name is Dr. Marshall Goldsmith. He is a world-renowned executive coach, and he is here talking about his latest book, Triggers, Creating Behavior Change That Lasts, Becoming the Person You Want to Be. You can learn all about his work at marshallgoldsmith.com. That's marshallgoldsmith.com. Marshall, I want this segment of the program to be mostly yours in terms of the direction we head. But the one thing I think we should bring up is that the ability to disengage is quite a life skill.
And, you know, it's interesting because it's a lot of discipline.
It is.
It's a hard discipline because we just have a tendency to get sucked in. And by whatever's there, the screaming driver, the person making the snide remarks, and we have a tendency to get sucked into this vortex of stuff. It really, it's not what we planned on doing for the day. It's not becoming the person we want to become. And the ability to disengage and realize, you know, I don't have to do that. And I talk about this model called the Wheel of Change in the book, and part of it is positive, negative, and then change and keep. And the positive keep is creating. Who's the new me I want to create in the future? Then the positive keep, that's called preserving. What is it about the past I want to preserve? Then the negative change is called eliminating, but then there's a negative keep, which is puzzling to a lot of people. Well, that's called accepting. Some things in life aren't wonderful, but I'm not going to do anything about them anyway. Make peace. Make peace and really focus on where I can make a positive difference as opposed to becoming focused on where I can't make a positive difference.
In those situations, I found it effective to pretend like I'm watching a movie.
A great idea, because then actually you get a little distance.
Yes.
You get a little distance, so then you're not right in the middle of it.
Yeah, the nobody in the screen is asking you what you think of the plot line.
That's right.
What would you like to impart these last few minutes, Marshall? I don't know how you feel like the hour's gone, but I have really enjoyed it.
Oh, I've had a great time. Let me give people my final advice, which is the daily questions and active questions.
Okay.
I went to a presentation on employee engagement, and they talked about everything companies are going to do to engage people, and there was no focus on what people can do to engage themselves at all, zero. So I thought, really, people need to focus on engaging themselves. And my daughter came up with this idea of active questions. Every day, asking yourself questions that begin with a phrase called, did I do my best to? And the six we talk about in the book are, did I do my best to set clear goals? So every day, challenge yourself with this question, did I do my best to set clear goals? Number two, did I do my best to make progress toward goal achievement? So not only did I set my goals, did I do my best to make progress toward achieving them? Number three, did I do my best to find meaning? Rather than saying, did someone else give me meaning, did I do my best to create meaning? Did I do my best to be happy? as opposed to did someone else make me happy? Did I do my best to make myself happy? Did I do my best to build positive relationships? Rather than saying, was everyone in the world nice to me? Did I do a good job of building positive relationships with people I met? And then finally, did I do my best to be fully engaged? Did I do my best to be engaged in life, engaged in what I was doing, as opposed to waiting for someone else to do something that's going to make me engaged? We've done 79 research studies. Anybody wants to participate in the research, send me an email, marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com, and Marshall has two L's, and just write 6-question research. I'll enroll you in the study. We've done 79 studies, 2,537 participants, and the results are amazing. 10 days later, 37% of the people who participate say, I'm better at everything. Clear goals, more meaning, happiness. 65% said I got better on at least 4 out of 6. 89% said I got better on at least 1. About 11% stayed the same, and 0.4% got worse. Why? Every day these questions get us to focus not on what we cannot change in life. They get me to focus on what I can change, and what's the one thing I can always control? Did I do my best?
Right.
And if I didn't, I can't blame that on someone else.
I love it. It's like a compass you keep staring at to remind yourself where you're going.
I every day, did I do my best? And if you had to imagine you had to go to a meeting, a boring meeting, stupid PowerPoint slides, you're dreading it. And I've given this case study to thousands of people. I've said if you were asked those 6 questions at the end of the meeting and tested on them, would you change your behavior? And 100% of the people say yes. I'd be more engaged. I'd listen. I'd be more positive. And you know, I said, do test yourself.
I wish we had more time. Dr. Marshall Goldsmith, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
And thank you, everybody else, for listening to Doing What Works.
This broadcast of Doing What Works is copyrighted by North Shore Productions. To learn more, please visit maureenanderson.com.